Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Dennis Mahoney's new novel, Bellwether, is a mystery adventure about a young woman confronting dangers in a reimagined fantastical 18th century. Consider it a big old-fashioned suspense story in a strangely familiar world. When tavern owner Tom Orange pulls a mysterious woman out of a flooded river, he knows immediately that their fates will deeply intertwine. Dennis Mahoney is the author of Fellow Mortals, a Booklist Top 10 debut in 2013, and it's a pleasure to welcome Dennis Mahoney to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me today.
Great pleasure to have you on the program. Was it always your intention to write about a place that is not the place that we are currently living on?
I think whenever I begin a book, I'm reimagining the world in some way and looking at it through my own particular lens. We often have weird lenses to look at things. And this book was an advancement of that, where I allowed my imagination to roam more freely. And I've spoken of this in a couple other places, but a lot of it came from being the parent of an 11-year-old boy, going through stories and rediscovering things, discovering new things with him, and seeing stories through his eyes. Understanding again why they're important to us and why falling into fictional worlds is so fascinating and so powerful, especially at certain ages in your life. It's something I had begun to lose as I was getting older and drying up a little. And becoming a parent was very reinvigorating. And I really just wanted a place where I could go and get lost and play. I knew it was going to be a book that took me a while to write, and I didn't want a book that was not fun or thrilling to write. So I succeeded in that. I really entertained myself for 2 years.
In the end pages of the book, there is a map. And the map tells us about this world, the known world. Do you have to create that in your mind prior to the actual writing?
I did it on the fly. I originally established this world as a version of early America in the late 1700s. Imagine just before the Revolutionary War. So I began situating myself there. And then as I began to develop this world and added the magical and fantastical elements, which are subtle. I wouldn't call this a fantasy book necessarily. It's strange plants and weather and animals, but there aren't wizards running around. There aren't dragons. The people themselves aren't magic. They're just in this astonishing, wondrous world. Which I think is probably how they viewed the New World in reality at the time.
It seems almost more peculiar than it does fantastical.
Yes, I'd say that's a good example. And oftentimes I would, you know, be researching the actual period because I wanted it to feel real. I wanted to know how a flintlock rifle worked. I wanted to know what kind of pants they wore. And I'd begin to research astonishing weather phenomena or strange nature, and it was almost always weirder than something I'd come up with. I would imagine a 10-foot snowfall, and I'd find out Boston had a 20-foot snowfall at some point. So it was almost hard to outdo reality in terms of the fantasy elements.
And how married were you to the truth in the sense of if you have a 10-foot snowstorm, then you think to yourself, oh, okay, well, if that's already been done, then I'll think of something else? Or do you say, oh, no, then this has actually been verified. I will use this.
I would just use whatever I wanted to. And sometimes I would look up how people would deal with something like that. There's a peculiar form of electricity in this book called St. Verna's Fire.
Yes.
Modeled slightly on St. Elmo's fire, but different. It happens on land. It attaches to people, makes you glow green for a while. And it's very frightening and very strange. And it's that kind of world where things like this are occurring. There are strange creatures in the woods, and there's mystery around every corner. And so I wanted that air of danger and thrill in the entire story as the character was trying to work her way into finding a home.
So talk a little bit about the, again, sort of where these things develop, you say, on the fly. So something like St. Verno's Fire, is that in the writing process, or do you think of that along the way and say, I want to incorporate this in some way, shape, or form through the course of the novel?
I plotted this book more than I've plotted other books. It's non-chronological. There are mystery elements. I needed to know where it was going to figure things out in advance and deploy them correctly in a narrative way. So a lot of stuff I created as I got there. And almost everything in the book is there to illuminate the characters, in some way challenge them in a new way, move the plot forward, put them in a bad situation, put them in an exciting situation. It generally reflected the story. And I would often have an idea of what type of element would be most potent at any given time. And I would play with ideas until I thought, well, that's the one. This is the time she meets the bear, and here's where she's in the ocean and this happens. But again, all in the service of what's going on with the character dynamics.
These are winter bears.
Winter bears, which are made up.
Yes.
Yeah, they
kind of wolf-like.
Yeah, and they hibernate in summer, which is actually called estivating.
I didn't know that.
I learned that along the way.
How much freedom does that give you when you create something like that? As you say, you make up a lot of it on the fly. So as you're writing, that seems playful. You used that word earlier, that you can go in and there is a fun aspect to the creation.
That's true. It's hugely liberating early on to be able to do everything. It can be a little terrifying because you can do anything. It was one reason I changed all the country names and I've altered history. I wanted, if the story were to continue on and on, I wanted to go anywhere I felt like or anywhere the characters needed to go. I didn't want to be bound by the historical rules of what happened in 1763 or 64. And as you get into the story, though, it begins to develop its own rules, and you can't break them. Every story has its own set of reality. So once I have established a certain seasonal cycle or a certain psychological state for a character, I can't just break that as a whim. The whims begin to reduce. Once I've established the maps, I know that it's always going to be 30 miles from one place to another, and that's not going to shift ever. As I began writing the sequel recently, I found that I was using this book as a primary source. I had maps to refer to, and it's been interesting that way.
And you know where you're going and where these characters can go geographically, if not literally.
Yes. And both.
Yes. So when you decide to bring yourself and to us, the reader, to this place, is it a place that you want us to be comfortable with fairly soon or wary of?
I'd say comfortable, but excited by the strangeness of it. It's tantalizing to visit a place that you do feel like you know, but something's a little bit off. And I find that that's often the best effect of fiction, where you vanish into this place that isn't quite familiar, but is familiar enough where your emotions are engaged. Or maybe it's some place you'd like to visit. We all know London. We know what modern London looks like, but we like visiting Sherlock's London because it has a special kind of quality that may never have actually existed, but it's very, very real to us now. And I love the escape factor of certain stories like that. It's not entirely escapism. That's often a dirty word. It's the best kind of escapism, and that you can let your own imagination unfold in a different place.
Tell us a little bit about, as I mentioned in the introduction, so this begins with Tom Orange pulling this mysterious woman. This is a woman who ultimately claims that she can't remember much more than her name, which
right.
is Molly.
And Molly is the hero of the story. She's the heroine. And it begins with the usual cliche of the man saving the woman, the damsel in distress. And it turns out that it's quite the opposite. She's really running the show. And she's very much the master of her own destiny. The book quickly goes back in time to her birth. The fourth chapter, we see her being born, and we see where she came from. And she has a brother named Nicholas, who from a very early age is clearly a genius and clearly creepy. He's a very dark individual. He's very much trying to be the master of his own fate. And he loves her dearly, but he is dangerous. And they escape a brutal father together and sail overseas to this new world to begin again. And that's really where the adventure leads her. The question is, how did she end up in this river? And where has the brother gone? And what exactly did happen once they boarded that ship? And that begins to unfold over the course of the remainder of the novel.
Do you ever worry about too much complexity?
I did to a degree, but again, having gone in and plotted the entire story, the goal was ultimately to make it highly readable. It's very easy to follow. I don't think readers will ever be confused reading this story, and I work very hard to make sure that the language is clear and simple and direct. And if you give yourself over to it, I think you'll just flow along and you'll learn enough at each stage where it doesn't overwhelm. And then when things begin to click, it really begins to come together in an interesting way for readers.
As you mentioned, Molly is the heroine of the novel, and what she's really good at, amongst many things, but she can certainly get herself out of a jam.
She can, and often gets herself into them first. I love characters that drive the narrative. An early mistake a lot of young writers make, and God knows I made it for years, is coming up with a very interesting situation and putting in an everyman or an everywoman and seeing how they will respond to some external problem. And sometimes that kind of story can really work well, and I find that other times the best stories are when the characters themselves are the engines. You can't have Hamlet without Hamlet. It wouldn't have worked with anyone else.
Right.
It's specifically about that one person. And so, you know, in my previous novel, Fellow Mortals, it was all about this mailman who accidentally started a neighborhood fire on his route and then moved heaven and earth to make it up to the victims. But in every moment that Henry was present, it was all about what he was doing and how people were responding to him. The same thing happens with Molly. I don't want readers to be thinking, oh, the author is steering us a certain way. I really want them to feel that they're following this character who feels very much alive, makes mistakes, and then does her best to recover from them.
The name of the novel is Bellwether by Dennis Mahoney. Dennis is our guest on the book show this week. The book is published by Henry Holt. Talk to us about the evil aspect of the book, so the bad guys. This is the Maimers.
They're forest thieves. Most of the story is occurring in a small town called Root in the middle of nowhere, about 50 miles from anything, surrounded by true original wilderness. And there is one road that leads from one major city through Root and into another major city. It's a horrible road to travel, but it happens to be fairly convenient for rushed trips and mail. And there are forest thieves on this road called the Maimers who are terrorizing the people who are traveling here, which is obviously very bad for Root and very bad for anyone who needs to get city to city. Their method of attack is that they'll steal everything their victim has, including the most important part of their body, which they will determine on the spot. So if you have a very talkative victim, they will take your tongue. And if it's an old man with an incredibly magnificent beard, they might clip his beard. In that case, he gets off pretty easy compared to some of the other victims.
Right.
It's pretty clearly a terror campaign of sorts. And the story is unfolding that they're trying to figure out what it is they want and what these people are doing out there. Why are they trying to scare people off the road?
Is there a balance in deciding when, as you say, it was plotted and you carefully plotted it so that you wanted there to be this rollicking adventure story so we learn just so much, you dole out to us how much we know about Molly and her past, and that seems like a delicate balancing act.
It is. A lot of this book was an embrace of these old storytelling tricks and tropes. For years, I probably wrongly rejected a lot of things that just work, like red herrings and cliffhangers and suspense and mystery. And I think most readers, including myself, really enjoy them when they're done well. So knowing Molly's story in advance, having worked it out, I was able to trickle things out as needed. And again, to enhance the emotions of the moment in each scene, as she's developing relationships with people in the town, as they suspect her of being troublesome or dangerous, her revelations help her or hurt her, but always add to the human complexity of the situation.
You mentioned early on that a lot of this came from being the father of an 11-year-old,
yeah.
of reading these stories and sort of being in that world. Are there particular stories that you can point to or name that got you into that mode of thinking of what can be created?
It was a lot of things. I've brought up Star Wars a lot because I saw The Empire Strikes Back when I was 6, and it blew my mind, and it certainly put me on an imaginative path. As I got older, you know, I really began reading seriously in late high school, which is fairly late, and that was very heavy-duty, classic, old literature. It took a while to get to the point where I was allowing myself to have fun with it, and I think that's what my son opened for me again. Reading the Harry Potter series with him was just a delight. It was a wonderful thing. Watching him get addicted to all of these dystopian trilogies that are out. And another big influence was the great television of the last 10 years. I think beginning with The Sopranos and, you know, moving on to things like Breaking Bad, where TV has just become so excellent and so novelistic in its approach. It's these 10, 13 episode series. They really feel like single pieces. They feel like a novel. And I love the balance that both the better YA authors and the better television shows are finding between high art and pop, where you can have a million crazy, eye-catching things going on in any given episode or book without sacrificing the character depth. I don't think anyone would look at Walter White in Breaking Bad and think that was a shallow character that was moving an exciting plot on a regular basis.
Right.
I think people would say the opposite.
That's fascinating. Were you ever perhaps put into or directed by anyone, editor or anyone at the publisher, that said that maybe this should be a young adult book, a YA?
It came close. I mean, there are a few scenes in here that I won't read to my son as I'm reading the book, adult situations, quote unquote. But it's pretty close. Otherwise, yeah, it would appeal to a teenager, certainly. I mean, it's nothing super explicit. A lot of YA is quite explicit at this point. You know, you've got 17 and 18-year-olds, if they're watching R-rated movies, they're seeing it all anyway on the internet, which isn't to say I want to be corrupting the youth, but if the story calls for moments of violence or moments of sexuality, I feel weird self-censoring.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm not somebody who's just writing wall-to-wall adult material and violent scenes for the sake of putting it in to make it exciting. It's there for a reason, and I tend to think of who it might appeal to later.
And, of course, there is that labeling of a novel, so if it suddenly becomes a YA novel, then that just all of these strange things happen. It becomes smaller. The physical object of the book becomes just a little bit smaller. It becomes a little bit cheaper, oddly. And the audience is different. And it's marketed not as a literary adventure story, as this is being marketed. It is instead marketed to a youth market and is in often a completely different section, not to mention often a different store. So I assume that's a conscious decision that you as an author has to make of how you ultimately want your career to go.
Yes. And I'm not always as savvy with that as maybe I should be. The marketing mentality tends to come second. It might be better to do it a little bit up front. And I think with the next book I'm working on, which I don't want to get into details, I am already putting on that hat a little in advance and thinking a bit more precisely who I'm trying to write for. And it's an interesting exercise. It's an interesting way to approach it.
Because you don't want to screw up the art. You don't want to screw
exactly.
You don't want to screw up the creativity of that idea. Perhaps it's an antiquated idea, but it's a lovely idea of you, the author, sitting before a blank page and creating something.
Right. Most of the great authors in history have had very specific audiences in mind. I would say most authors, however ivory tower artistic they're behaving, want to be read, and they are thinking of a readership. And I think very few published writers are writing these things and saying, I don't care who this appeals to, and this is my masterpiece, and take it or leave it, and they're winging it to the masses. Shakespeare remains the ultimate example of this. He was trying to fill a theater, and he knew he had to appeal to the cheap ticket holders. He was appealing to the groundlings on the floor who were laughing at the dirty sex jokes and the crazy puns, and in that context was also writing as high an art as he could. He was writing this gorgeous poetry into these lines, and it worked. There was something that appealed for both sets of people. Again, going back to my earlier example of that very high-low art combination that I think is possible and is an interesting goal.
And it is your idea, of course, to, you know, we use the word literary, which can often be, you know, a bad word for sales, but yet it shows, as you say, I want to do the scene, but I want to do it well. I want to make it a good scene. I want it to be beautifully written, and not to sacrifice that in any way.
Right. I love the idea. I think, again, like most writers, of reaching a wide audience.
Right.
But I don't like the idea of writing trash. I'm not trying to foist something over. I'm not making pure candy. And there's a place for pure candy. We all love absolutely horrible pop songs on the radio that are just catchy for half a summer.
Yeah.
And that's great. I want a little bit of both. I mean, I think it's good to be able to write well-rounded characters with complex plots, pay attention to the language, bring all my art to bear, and also make it something that you can rip through on a weekend, that it's really fun to blast through 400 pages of a suspenseful story.
That is one thing that about the story that is so much fun to read, is that it is suspenseful, that it is rather rollicking in nature, which keeps it at a pretty good pace.
Mm-hmm.
And pacing, I find, is a fascinating thing. It's that wanting to know what happens. This mystery, and how far am I going to have to go ahead to find out the answer to that?
And you indicated before, balance is the word.
Yeah.
You don't want to tease to the point where readers are just getting frustrated that you're not giving them anything. You don't want to spill too much too soon. I hear True Detective Season 2 is getting dumped on quite a bit because it's a little too little payoff every week. They kind of keep hinting at dread and mystery, and nothing is really moving forward in a way. It may change, I don't know. But that kind of, and it's a balance he's walking, and it worked in Season 1, and it's not working quite as well in Season 2.
And right, you want some payoff. Even in a chapter, you want payoff. You want there to be something to say, oh, okay, I'm going to stay up till 10 o'clock to read this. I want something out of that experience.
Mm-hmm. I can get very high art on this and say Aristotle had a lot to say about this. I'm forgetting the word he used. But there is a...
You've already impressed me with Aristotle, so you don't have to get the exact word.
Yeah, the sense of propulsion, the sense of forward movement, that wherever the story begins, it should be leading you constantly leading you forward towards something. Maybe not a preordained end, but you shouldn't feel like you're treading water.
You mentioned, of course, that you were working on a sequel, and also mentioned that you don't want to give too much away, which I certainly understand. Was it the intention as you started writing this and plotting it that it would go on, or is it through the writing process that you said, oh, there's more here?
It was always conceived as probably the first of 5 books.
Okay.
And I have a general trajectory. The fourth and fifth are very hazy, but I have the entire second book is worked out. I just have to write it at this point. I'm about 100 pages in. The third book, I have a pretty good idea of what that will be, and then really hazy ideas on 4 and 5. Again, plotting only goes so far. You do get to a point where you have to really figure out what would the character's logical next move be. What would a human being really do at that moment? And the author has to step back and allow that to happen.
Sure.
If I overplot it, it's going to feel like I'm forcing some kind of story on you. So I need to see where they are at the end of book 2 in order to really understand what book 3 is going to be.
Well, the new book is Bellwether. It is published by Henry Holt. Dennis Mahoney, I thank you very much for sharing with us, and best of luck with the new novel.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you here. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
Come on, listen to the wheel whistle away. I belong to the stars in the day. I ran away, eternal instigator. Oh, I was old. I remember the Milky Way. Why? I belong to the stars in the sky.